Hello and welcome to Fantastic Fights, the podcast about a middle-aged man playing adventure game books out loud on the internet. That middle-aged man is me, Hieronymus J. Doom, and this episode we're looking at Tower of Destruction, book 46 in the long-running fighting fantasy series. Before we get into that, we've got a few notices. Firstly, I need to thank a new patron, a kind soul, who has gone to patreon.com/HJDoom and pledged as little as a single English pound to support my nonsense. Dan, thanks so much for your support. It is much appreciated. All patrons do, of course, receive a haul of gaming material by way of a thank you. And on that note, I've definitely decided what my next gamebook is going to look like, and I'll be cracking on with it just as soon as the Lindebaum Prize is out of the way. Speaking of which, the public voting for the Lindebaum Prize is now open. If you go to the Lloyd of Gamebooks blog, there's 9 100-page gamebooks that talented creators have written for the competition. That's around 900 sections of free gamebooks for you to play and vote on. Check it out if you've got some free time. Now on with the show. Tower of Destruction was written by Keith Martin, with interior art by Peter Nifton, and gloriously literal cover by fighting fantasy veteran Terry Oakes, that shows the titular tower falling from the sky and spitting fire. I generally prefer the covers where the artist has the chance to pull something a bit less obvious from the text, because I like spotting the cover art inspiration when it crops up, but you can't argue with a massive tower falling from the sky like a bomb. It's a strong image. Peter Nifton is an illustrator who did a bunch of work for various gaming companies throughout the late 80s to the early 90s. This is his first fighting fantasy book, so I'll be interested to see how his art compares. Keith Martin is also something of a veteran at this point, having already given us several books in the series: The Solid Stealer of Souls, the excellent Vault of the Vampire, and the intriguing but slightly flawed Master of Chaos. He's shown a real willingness to experiment and try different things, so I've got some high hopes for this one. Let's take a look at the rules. Tower of Destruction sticks fairly close to the classic rule set, with skill, stamina, and luck all present and correct as expected. The random provisions generator has selected 10 provisions for this adventure, which is pleasantly old school. You've got a sword, a shield, and some fur-lined leather armour suitable for cold climates, and that's your lot. We do, however, get a couple of additional rules. Firstly, we get an honour score, which starts at 6 and can go up or down depending on how we play. I'm of two minds with this. On a mechanical level, it's fine. Giving you a starting value rather than randomly generating it makes it fairly easy to balance, but morality systems are very hard to do well in gamebooks because a lot of the time, moral decisions involve shades of grey which abstract systems struggle to operationalise. It's usually okay in tabletop games. You can have a discussion with the game's master about the moral implications of your actions, but game books and also video games tend to struggle with morality. Often the options tend to be too extreme. I've played a number of old video games where the moral options were behave like a reasonable human being, and the immoral options were behave like someone with a serious personality disorder. Do you want to help the little old lady cross the road? Or do you want to steal her purse, fill it with custard, and throw it in her stupid face? Added to which, these systems always involve the writer being the ultimate arbiter of what constitutes moral behaviour, and that means they have a tendency to reveal some unconscious biases. My own personal moral position is that of an anarchist and a Gnostic Christian, which means that I have strong views on the inherent evil of inequalities of power. And that's not something that most gamebooks really explore. They usually assume that hereditary power is just fine, that inequality is simply an inevitability, and that private property doesn't require justification. People might argue that such views didn't really exist in the medieval world they're drawing on for inspiration, but then I would point out that the Cathars were very much a real thing that existed. If I'm playing in a game of Dungeons and Dragons, I can play a character who holds a version of those views, even if they're quite fringe and even if they're not supported by the game's master or indeed the setting in which they're portrayed. In a game book, however, I'm trapped in whatever moral structure the author has decided for me. You can do interesting things with that, but it's very hard. All game books do this to some extent, but I think trying to foreground moral systems draws attention to it in ways that can be quite unhelpful. That said, I am going to be slightly hypocritical and say that if you are going to include morality, then something like honour is one of the better choices, because honour is a little harder to nail down than good or evil, and I think that helps smooth out some of the issues that you might come across. It's also something that was and is a key concern in many martial societies. It can encompass honesty, but also sensitivity to personal slights and a somewhat transactional view of personal relations that I think can be operationalized into something structured, which is good in environments with limited choices, like game books. Someone honourable might be considered good, but it's not a perfect synonym for good, which can be useful. I think it would have been nice to have the character explicitly be part of the upper echelons of society, a knight or something, because these are the people who tend to be more concerned with honour. Adventurers tend towards the chaotic end of the old-school alignment spectrum, and honour is often tied into codes of behaviour that sit uncomfortably with the roguish but ultimately good-hearted hero of these kinds of adventure stories. So I'm going to be very interested to see how that plays out in practice. The rules section also warns us that we need to track time during the early stages of the adventure and lets us know that we might find some magic and a crossbow somewhere along the way. You could keep that as a surprise, but I do like to be tantalised from time to time, and a heads up to keep an eye out for magic can be useful, since magic items have a weird tendency to look like junk. Right, I think that's everything. I have rolled up a character who I've decided to call Fiesta Ziplock, because I think that sounds like a very honourable name. They have a skill of 8, a stamina of 23, and a whopping luck of 12, and I rolled those completely honestly. Their starting honour is 6, so without any further ado, let's play Tower of Destruction. Background. I have been moving towards thinking that reading the entire background is probably unnecessary, but in this case it's only a page and a half long, so I'm going to do the whole thing as usual. It has been a long, hard trek from the market in the city of Zengis, but you are almost home now. Within the hour you should be back at the family hearth, a tankard of warm mead in your hand, and your furred leathers hanging in the corner of the hut. Doubtless your friends will come around to talk about their exploits while hunting when you were away at the market, and they will probably mock you gently for not having gone hunting with them. Well, someone had to haggle to get a good price for the furs, and as the chieftain pointed out, it might as well be someone with a few brains and a little sense. So you had got the job. So that's very efficient already, telling us that we are a relatively low-status individual, someone who lives in a village, and a village with a relatively old-school kind of organisation. The use of chieftain of the village signals a kind of tribal structure. Amazing how just choosing one specific word can really give you a sense of how a society is organised. If they'd said like mayor or squire, that would have created a very different impression. Perhaps, you imagine, life would be easier in one of the southern lands of Alanzia you have heard of. Wicked Port Blacksand to the south and west, and the endless flatlands with their proud wild horses and prouder riders. Even Arantis, so far away with its overpriest and teeming pirate ships. Anywhere might be better than this bitingly cold region where you have spent your life in the shadow of the Icefinger Mountains. Perhaps, when the next caravan sets out from Zengis to the flatlands, you may find a merchant who needs a strong and honest bodyguard. But that's a fantasy, and what's real now is the cold. Except that now it isn't as cold as it seemed to be a minute ago. It should be, because the sky is darkening as dusk descends, so it should strike chill indeed. But why is the sky darkening? You realise that it is not long since the watery autumnal sun was at its zenith. And what is the horrible screeching and booming sound coming out of the sky towards you? You spin round and face the direction from which the ever louder sound is coming, and throw yourself to the ground in abject terror. With a great wailing like a thousand screaming demons, the black sphere of rock shoots past overhead, fire and smoke trailing in its wake. A chunk of molten rock plummets and crashes into the ground close to you, hissing and spitting as it embeds itself in the snow and ice-hardened ground. You get up, shake the snow off your clothes and run forward to the head of the valley. Peering down, you see that the valley is shrouded in smoke and you can make out tongues of flame rising from the place where you know your home is. You rush on down to find out what terrible fate has befallen your home and your people. And we are straight on to the first section. You gasp for breath as you run, flat out to your home. Even as you race down the snow-covered slope, you can hear the screams and the wails of the dying. Thick, black, reeking smoke is mercifully beginning to disperse, only to reveal burned corpses and still alive but injured villagers. Huts and cabins are either aflame or completely flattened by the passage of the sphere. To your horror, you find your mother and father dead in the ruins of their home. You rage with fury and swear an oath to track the progress of the killing sphere and to find out what has brought this terrible carnage upon your people. What will you do now? So this is a great introduction. I love it when we just get thrown straight into the action, and I also love it when writers show that they've got some familiarity with the fighting fantasy world. Always nice to see a reference to Port Blacksand, one of the great cities of fantasy literature. And yeah, there is a picture as well. I'm not mad keen on it, in all honesty. It looks a little bit simplistic and cartoonish. There's a set of ruins with a few shattered remnants of houses and black smoke and flames and mountains in the background and a lowering sky. But yeah, there's just something that about it that just seems somehow crude in a way that I can't quite put my finger on. I don't think it's great. Still, we must make a decision. Do we want to leave and follow the trail of the sphere at once? Look around for things that will be of help to you on your trek after the sphere. Look for the village wise man or do what you can to help the injured. So with honour at the back of my mind, I think from these options, all of which sound reasonable, I'm probably going to do what I can to help the injured. I might find the village wise man while helping the injured, and I might find something useful while helping the injured as well. And also at the back of my mind, as well as honour, I got the reminder that time is also a factor. So this is a great example of how systems can be used to make decisions more interesting, even if those systems are not being directly referenced in the text, which is cool. You help bandaging the injured and comforting the survivors, and then you hear a feeble cry coming from a pile of rubble, a child's cry for help. You scrabble frantically at the rocks and manage to get a cowering girl out from the cellar after an hour of hard work. But the brickwork and stones are very loose, and now you must test your luck. With my luck being 12, I am automatically lucky. Luck now 11. Soon after you manage to rescue the child, the whole hut collapses. Your rescue was in the nick of time. Gain 1 honour point. Honour now 7. The other villagers have done what they can for the other wounded. Now you sit down with them to discuss what happened. Their story adds nothing to what you already knew. The huge fiery sphere passed by overhead, but seemed to dip as it flew over the village, as if to cause as much damage and distress as possible. Then it flew off northwards. No one among the villagers can pursue the murderous sphere. Many are injured, and of the fit, some must tend the wounded, and the rest are already preparing to hurry to distant Zengis to buy healing and herbal medicines. They are proud of you, for going on alone in pursuit of the sphere, but they cannot accompany you. They do give you some climbing gear though, ice picks, some rope and a small hammer. Note this down. They also give you a flask of brandy. There are two large swigs of brandy here, each of which will restore 4 lost stamina points when drunk. We accept that food has miraculous healing properties in this world, but I really feel as though a mouthful of brandy is not going to solve any health problem that you might have, unless your health problem is being unnecessarily sober, in which case it will. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm delighted to have 2 swigs of brandy on top of the 10 provisions I've already got, but it's even odder than the food restores health thing for me. Finally, if you have lost any stamina, you can now eat enough food to raise your current stamina back to its initial level. It's too dark to continue now, so you spend the night asleep in one of the few dwellings left standing on the village. In the morning, you set off northwards with the good wishes of your fellows ringing in your ears. So we've got some stuff, we've got some more honour, and we've used up a day, so nice little bit of balance there. Further north, the sphere has left a trail of melted snow and ice, which is already freezing over again as you plough ahead. The sun sets at the end of the day, and a biting wind springs up from the north. You look around, hoping you might find shelter in the straggly clumps of pine trees dotted around. The trees look only slightly singed. The sphere must have been flying a little higher here. You hear what sounds like the hooting of a snow owl on your right. You could try the trees on that side, or you could try the ones on your left. I will try the trees on the right because I'm a big fan of owls. I love an owl. They're one of my favourite birds. So yeah, we'll go and see if we can spot an owl whilst we're resting. Entering the group of pines, you see a huge, ghostly white snow owl perched on a tall tree straight ahead. Its amber eyes glimmer in the shadows of dusk. These great birds are very territorial, so you may want to back away and make for the other group of pines. Or you can move ahead regardless. Well, I've seen the owl. I'm happy. I'm perfectly willing to leave it to its owly business. I'm sure it's got some owl stuff it really needs to be getting on with. So I will make for the other group of pines. Unrolling your blanket, you settle down to sleep on the deserted clump of pines. Roll 1 die. I get a 1. And that means something bad happens, because something bad happens on a 1 or a 2. Am I going to wake up to find an owl sitting on my chest? You are awoken by the snuffling of a grizzly bear in the woods. Grizzlies are hungry brutes and have a nasty temper. Do you want to attack the bear? Do you want to clamber up a tree to hide? I mean, bears can climb. Or do you want to lay down some food to delay the bear and sneak off elsewhere? We will go for laying down the food. You throw some food to the bear, subtract 2 meals from your provisions. You head off somewhere else to find a place to sleep, but the bear just follows your scent. It knows a free lunch when it smells one. It wants more food. Ideally, it would like to eat you. I guess that massive Toblerone and the packet of cheesy Wotsits. Very much an aperitif for the average bear. So I can throw the bear more food. That seems like a foolish idea at this point. That's just throwing more food away. I can attack the bear. I can climb up the tree to hide. I will climb up the tree to hide. I've got nothing against bears. Bears are awesome. The bear snuffles hungrily about for the prey it smells, and it even shakes the tree you're in. It doesn't go away until dawn. You get no sleep, and your muscles ache abominably. Deduct 2 points from your stamina. Stamina now 21. When the coast is clear, you clamber down the tree. Well, that seems fine. If I was to fight the bear, unless it was really bad at fighting, with my skill of 8, I probably would have lost more than 2 points of stamina. So, that's fine. Being tired, it's a nice bit of colour for the story, but it doesn't actually have an in-game effect. So, yeah, I'm reasonably happy with that. The trail continues northwards with no sign of the sphere itself, but there are plentiful signals of its passing in the blackened leaves, the frozen pools and slush, and in the smell of burning. The grimness of the scene matches the grimness of your face as you doggedly follow the trail. See, in real life, I'm blessed with one of those faces that looks grim, sad, slightly angry, sullen, possibly, would be the best turn of phrase. Nice to have my character's grimness matched by my own less than welcoming visage. At the end of the day, you find a dead snow fox in a snare. The animal only died recently. The body is still warm, but will swiftly chill. You can take the snow fox with you if you want. Add it to your possessions. Dead fox. You scoop out a snow hole in a drift and snuggle up inside it, an old barbarian trick, but one worth knowing. You must eat a meal before you go to sleep, but your night's rest is undisturbed. So, tuck into a boil-in-the-bag chicken korma and get a good night's sleep. But in the morning, you must eat another meal. So hopefully I've got some Cocoa Pops somewhere amongst my provisions. My provisions are now down to 6. Then you set off in the increasingly steep rocky slopes ahead, following the fire-blasted path of the fiery killer from the sky. Walking is hard work, and your calves ache with the pain. You have to stop and rub your protesting leg muscles several times during the day. At last, at the top of one peak looking down, you see a valley a good few kilometres ahead and a thick carpet of smoke. You know that the sphere must have come to rest there. The trail leads right up to it. It will take over a day to get there, so you redouble your efforts. Struggling along, you see footprints ahead of you, a trail leading towards you and then slipping away in an obvious fall, descending into some pine scrub below. Do you want to detour and investigate, losing time, or do you want to press ahead? It's already been 3 days I've been travelling, but I can't not look. I think this might be one where I run out of time. My own unquenchable curiosity being my terminal weakness in this adventure, I think. Inching along, you make your way carefully down. But soon you see that the drop leads over a fairly steep rock overhang. Do you have climbing gear? I do indeed. You scramble easily down the slope and observe a semi-conscious figure spread awkwardly on the ground. You go over to see how he is. The half-conscious man lying here is a local, a fur-clad barbarian. Judging by the bloodied feathers at his belt, he's a clansman of the Bloodied Eagle tribe, one not noted for its friendly attitude to outsiders. But he is in pain, concussed and with an ugly wound to his head. He's very shaky and vulnerable. So we've got choices. Do we want to dress his wound and leave him, climbing back up to the trail? Clean his wound and stay with him to make sure he's okay, or kill him and steal his belongings? Out of curiosity, I am going to kill him and steal his belongings because I'm interested to see whether potentially saving the life of one person, which got me one honour, is considered an equivalent act to just straight up murdering a dude. You kill the poor barbarian who is unable to resist. You rifle through his possessions and take a pouch with 3 gold pieces, 2 provisions, and any of the following you want to take: a stone axe, an ivory-handled dagger, and a crude spear. You lose 2 points of honour for this cowardly and evil act. Okay, honour now 5. This highlights something which I'll probably talk about in more detail at the end. This highlights something that is an issue with all morality systems that try and assign a points value to morality, which is that if you do a really good thing and a really bad thing, they will cancel each other out. And that's a sort of unusual view of how morality actually works. Still, at least we lose 2 points of honour for the cowardly and evil act rather than just the 1 that we got from helping save a small child. The afternoon passes slowly. You soon work up a sweat as you stumble along paths littered with treacherous rocks half hidden under a blanket of snow. The smoky, hazy valley of the sphere seems never to get any closer, and you haven't made much progress by nightfall, but you do manage to find a cave, and within it a little dry wood, a flint and some tinder. You bless the traveller, who left this here for others to find, and soon you have a small fire cheering you with its warmth. You can even warm the provisions you use for the meal you must eat here. Soon the warmth of the fire makes you doze off, and you get a good night's rest. So, 4 days. So, tuck into some lovely warm vegetable pakora. That'll be nice. Oh, I could just go a vegetable pakora. Regardless, we have had a good night's rest, which is nice. In the morning, you must eat a meal. Well, I guess I've run out of Cocoa Pops, but I've probably got some porridge. There's always porridge. I mean, I really like porridge, but I would say, all things being equal, Cocoa Pops are nicer. Not that I'm allowed to eat Cocoa Pops. In the morning, you must eat a meal. Then you go outside and stretch your legs. And the first thing that catches your eye is a winged shape in the sky just to the south. It looks sizable, and if it's a white dragon, then it's a formidable beast indeed. You decide to wait for an hour and then look again, but when you venture outside once more, the creature is still there, circling the sky. What are you going to do? You can set off outside and head north, or stay inside the cave. Well, time really is starting to get a little bit pressing, so I'm going to just have to try and brave this white dragon. We'll go outside, we'll head north. You set off in a northerly direction, hoping that the creature flying around behind won't notice you. Now you must test your luck. 4. I am lucky. Luck now down to 10. I can press on northwards. This has been a very enjoyable tour through some classic wilderness fantasy encounters so far, you know. Had some animals, we've needed to forage for food. We've needed to protect ourselves from the elements, and a white dragon. That's kind of cool. You must eat a meal at the end of the day, and you manage to find somewhere secure to sleep. In the morning, when you must eat another meal, you find you are on a cliff top overlooking the valley. So 2 further meals down, to 4 provisions, and I think we're on 5 days now. The smoke is clearing, and in the valley lies the large rocky sphere, still spitting forth gouts of fire and plumes of filthy black smoke. There are a few small human-sized figures around the sphere. You are going to have a tricky climb down from here. Roll 2 dice and add 2 to the total unless you have the climbing gear. If you have the climbing gear, you may subtract 2 from the total. If the adjusted total is greater than your skill, you will stumble, graze your limbs, and suffer various knocks and scrapes. Deduct 4 from your stamina. If the total is less than or equal to your skill, you get down safely enough. Excellent. I have a skill of 8, but I can roll 2 dice and reduce it by 2, giving me a functional skill of 10. So 10 or less. 7. Brilliant. No problem for me at all. Now you stand a few hundred metres from the sphere, creeping forward through burnt and blackened tree stumps and rocks. Unfortunately, you have little cover, and you are soon spotted by 2 guards. They look like animated corpses, but they are blue-skinned. The water in their bodies is solid ice, and what seems to be breath is frosting on the air before them. Their eyes are vacant, and their faces expressionless. You have to fight the 2 ice ghosts here together. A slight change to the mass combat rules. Each attack round you must roll dice to determine the attack strengths for yourself and both of your opponents. The combatant with the highest attack strength is the one who gets a damaging blow in that round. Which is simpler, but less evocative. But it is arguably a slight improvement in terms of, sort of clear, concise rules. Anyway, with that, I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the ice ghosts. They reduced me to 13 points of stamina. I should say there is a picture of the ice ghosts, and honestly, it's rather better than the first illustration that we had. Peter Nifton seems to be reasonably good at posing figures in a way that looks dynamic. There's a sort of almost Marvel esque 1960s Marvel vibe to the posing, which I rather like. Really nice evocative bit of art. He's really drawn attention to the freezing breath misting from their mouths, which I like. You are now heading straight towards the sphere, and there isn't a great deal of cover directly ahead. You can continue in the same way, or sweep around to approach the sphere from the other side, where there appears to be better concealment for an approach. Well, as I consider my options, I'm going to take a swig from my brandy and increase my stamina back to 17. And I am going to sweep around to approach the sphere from the other side, where there seems to be better concealment. You move around the far side of the sphere, doing what any sensible person trying to sneak up unobserved would do, which is precisely why there is a guard here, of course. Suddenly, a pair of skeletal talons tear at your back. Deduct 2 points from your stamina. If you are still alive, you turn to face a grinning, robed, skeletal figure rending at you, and you must fight it. So, for the second time, I'm going to roll some dice. Oh, the demonic servant has a skill of 8 and a stamina of 7. With my skill of 8, this is a straight 50-50. I should survive. I should be fine. But anyway, dice rolling. I'm a gunner. Amazingly, the demonic servant only hit me once, reducing my stamina to 15. Suspiciously easy fight. I feel like I've used up all of my good luck on that fight. Hey-ho, but we have won. You edge forward behind what little rock cover there is, and you manage to get within a few metres of the sphere. It now seems smaller than you remembered, maybe only 10 or 12 metres across. But it lies in an area of shattered rock and melted snow and ice, and it radiates evil, as well as heat and stench. You can see what could be an entrance on one side of it. It looks like a wedge cut into the surface of the sphere, but all is blackness inside. So you wait for the cover of darkness, and at dusk you creep forward towards the sphere, right up to the entrance. Then, with a deep breath and a prayer to the gods of good, you step inside. You walk a few stealthy paces down a dimly lit passageway with smooth black walls, looking out for guards, but you see none. You soon come to a three-way junction within a gently humming, warm and slightly smoky body of the sphere. It's obvious that each of these passages continues for some distance. The interior of the sphere is clearly bigger than the outside size would seem to indicate was possible. This is obviously a very magical creation. Will you take the left-hand path, the right-hand path, or head straight on? Well, if you've been listening a while, you know that when we come to an option that allows us to go left, we go left. And actually, I've been recording for about 45 minutes, and this is the first opportunity to go left, which might be a record, might not. But yeah, we will go down the left-hand passage, mildly irritated by there being absolutely no further information with which to make a decision, but we will see where we end up. You make your way along a winding, featureless passage which opens into a bare spherical chamber of very odd design. You are about to enter it when a smoky shape starts to take form within the room and drifts soundlessly towards you. If you have been here before and fought this enemy, another has appeared in its place. Do you want to stay and see what happens, or do you want to flee and return to the main junction you came from? I will flee, thank you, having already fought this creature potentially. Not that I've already fought this creature, but the potential for having fought the creature before suggests that I could potentially return to this area. So I'll go and gather more information. Take the right-hand passage, I guess, on this occasion. You walk on tiptoe along a narrow passageway which slopes downwards, and soon you come to a door which has an iron grill set into it. In the chamber beyond is a very odd sight. A human-shaped pillar of rough, coarse stone holds in its hands a globe of very hot glowing rock, on which it is blowing a dusty yellow breath. If only there was another name for a human-shaped pillar. As the creature blows, the rock grows redder and redder. Then finally, the stone monster throws the rock in an arc across the room and into an aperture in the wall. The strange swirling darkness of the hole swallows up the flaming rock sphere, and it whistles away into the distance, leaving only a faint glow behind. Meanwhile, the stone creature has picked up a dully glowing rock from the pile at its feet and is beginning to blow on it, starting the process once again. This is all very strange, but it may have something to do with how the Great Sphere is powered, or so perhaps you want to stop it. On the other hand, the stone monster looks pretty formidable. What will you do? Well, there's a picture of the monster who... There's a sort of vague hint of the robot about it. Again, it's a really quite nice picture. It's a basic, slightly comic booky again, although with rather more detailed shading, perhaps, than you would expect from most Western comics at the time. Yeah, I like it. But what am I going to do? Am I going to open the door and attack? I feel as though that's a highway to nowhere. I'll return to the T-junction and take the middle path and see where that leads. No particular desire to tangle with a giant statue armed with a red-hot rock. You hurry on down a very long meandering passageway, which eventually opens into a circular chamber of black rock. Around the smooth walls are bronze rails and a circular stone staircase cut into both floor and ceiling leads up and down. Do you want to go up or down? Up, I think. Very much enjoying the weird sci-fi fantasy crossover elements of this story at this point. You climb up the black stone steps to a landing where you find a heavy door on one side and no other exits. You listen at the door, but you can hear nothing. You decide to open it. Test your luck. Luck currently 10. I roll an 8. I'm fine. Luck now 9. You are fortunate indeed, for you crouch down as you open the door and a volley of fiery darts hurtles over your head. Unfortunately for you, they're the least of the perils in this hot, dank chamber. Intriguing. What could it be? Within the gloomy recesses of the room, a pillar of fire suddenly bursts into prominence. A black, winged humanoid figure with the horns and hooves of a great goat and bearing a huge whip and sword snarls fury at you. You have chanced upon a fire demon. Fortunately for you, the fire demon isn't fully formed on this plane, away from its natural abode. It can be struck and hurt with magical weapons and isn't as powerful as usual. I think there might be a missing word non before that magical weapons line. And it isn't as powerful as usual. However, if you have taken 5 or 6 days to get to the sphere, you must add 1 to both its skill and stamina. If you've taken 7 days or more, you must add 1 to its skill and 2 to its stamina score. It has grown closer to full power with the passing of time. So the fire demon has a skill of 8 and a stamina of 8. I have taken 5 days, meaning that it has a skill of 9 and a stamina of 9. I'm going to take my last swig of brandy for some Dutch courage before tangling with this creature. Oh, it's got a special rule. Each attack round, the fire demon will shoot a stream of fire from its nostrils. This will cause 1 extra point of damage to your stamina on a die roll of 1 to 4, and 2 extra points if you spent 5 days getting here, which I have. The fire demon is not an easy enemy to defeat. It is not, and there is a really pretty cool illustration as well. I mean, shooting fire from your nostrils is never going to look anything other than a bit silly. But kudos to Peter Nifton for just reading the description and going, yep, that's what we're going with. Big bat-winged, balroggy type of creature with sort of slightly unnaturally long arms depicted sitting on its haunches. Yeah, it's a decent bit of work, quite honestly. Really decent bit of work. Anyway, skill 9, stamina 9, fire demon. I'm going to roll some dice and probably die. I have defeated the fire demon. I have been reduced to a single point of stamina, and my luck has gone down from 9 to 7. So, very, very narrowest of possible victories. I had to test my luck twice. That fire breathing from the nose job, that's really, really deadly. Yeah, very pleased. I've still got four provisions, so having already drunk all my brandy, I'm going to eat all four of my provisions in just the biggest possible blowout to get myself back to 17 stamina points. Yeah, just gorging myself on a combination of croissants, hummus, fizzy sherbet, and liver and onions until I feel less on fire. Yeah, serious business, that fire demon. But yeah, I have made it. That's good. You know better than to pick up a whip or a sword of a demon. Among the rubble and rubbish in this chamber, however, you find a metal chest, warm to the touch, but which you can open safely. While you are doing so, you hear sounds coming from one of the walls, a humming and throbbing, and what sounds like the crunch of metal striking metal, and a shouted curse. The control room, or the leaders of this contraption, must be on this level. If only there were a door here! But there isn't, only the one you came in by. Returning to the chest, you grab 6 gold pieces, ooh, 9 gold now, and a flask of dark liquid. This is a potion of fire breath. You can drink this at any time, except during combats, and in the first combat you come to afterwards, for 3 attack rounds, you will be able to breathe fire at the same time as using a weapon. Each attack round, you roll 1 die. On a roll of 1 to 4, your breath will strike your enemy and cause 2 points of damage to its stamina. On a roll of 5 or a 6, you miss. This must be done in the first combat you have after drinking the potion. Fire breath won't hurt fire elementals or demons, though. Makes sense. You leave here and take the stairs down to the next floor. You decide that there's no point in heading further down. You want to find a way back up. You head along the corridor to the point where you first came to the main junction. Standing facing in the same direction as when you entered, do you want to try the left-hand tunnel or the right-hand tunnel? Well, let's go for the left-hand one, and I am going to drink my potion of fire breath. You make your way along a winding, featureless passage which opens into a bare spherical chamber of a very odd design. You are about to enter it when a smoky shape starts to form within the room and drifts soundlessly towards you. Have you been here before and fought this enemy? I have not, so let's see what happens. I mean, I've been here before, but I haven't fought the enemy. The wisps of smoke form into a vaguely humanoid form, and the creature radiates hatred and malice. It glides over towards you and tries to choke the life out of you. So there's a picture of the smoke wraith. Again, really quite like it. I think Peter Nifton's style, a particularly good fit with monsters and humanoids. He just seems to be, very solid in that department. The smoke wraith has a skill of 8 and a stamina of 9. I wonder if the fire breathing will have an effect on it. I guess not. Anyway, skill 8, stamina 9. I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the smoke wraith. It reduced me to 11 points of damage. I'm going to explore the chamber. The chamber appears to be featureless and bare, but will you be able to find anything here? Slight issue in that the cat is in the room with me and is currently trying quite hard to dig his way through the first floor window. So anyway, I'm searching the chamber and I need to test my skill. Yay, I succeed. Hidden very cleverly in one of the walls is a secret sliding panel. Do you want to open the secret door? I surely do. The number of days you have taken on your journey now becomes important. Have you spent 5 or more days? I have. The creator of the sphere has had extra time in which to create guardians and monsters here. One of them lunges at you as soon as you open the secret door. It takes you by surprise, so you must deduct 2 points from your stamina because of the unexpected attack. The expressionless face of a zombie stares at you. Since its body, that of a northern barbarian, has not yet decomposed, it is tougher than most zombies. The barbarian zombie has a skill of 7 and a stamina of 9. It's reduced me to 9. I'm going to roll some dice! I have defeated the barbarian zombie. It reduced me to 7 points of stamina. You look into a round chamber in which a black stone circular staircase leads up into a gloom where nothing is discernible. There is a strong humming sound coming from the top of the stairs. You pluck up courage and climb the stairs. Then you come to a door which you force open. Inside is a long, narrow, chilly room, very different from the rest of the sphere, with many marble slabs lying along its sides. You can clearly make out the shapes of bodies beneath the dirty shrouds on the slabs. At the far end of the chamber is another door, and the humming sound is coming from that direction. Instinctively, you know that what lies beyond the door in the distance will give you the clue to the mysteries of the murderous sphere, so you press on. Have you spent more than 5 days getting to the sphere? I have. I'm going to have to fight some zombies. As you near the far door, a body on one of the slabs jerks upright. Blue-veined, grey-skinned, and radiating a deep chill and malice, the dead eyes of the animated horror roll back in its sockets, but it still senses your presence and wants to kill you. You must fight the ice ghost here. If you have only a sword or a spear, your weapon will do 1 point of damage on a roll of 1 to 3. On a single die, after you win an attack round, if you roll a 4 to 6, you get 2 points of damage. Heavy maces always do 2, because a blunt weapon crunches the frozen tissues of the ice ghost, causing more damage. So the ice ghost has a skill of 7 and a stamina of 8. I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the ice ghost and I am now down to 3 points of stamina, this adventure being very much the death of 1,000 cuts. If you win, something awful happens to the ice ghost. Its head appears to crack open and its spirit hangs in the air in a tiny cloud of frosted fog before seeping away, and a ghastly moan issues from its throat while this is happening. Repulsed by this sight and eager to get away, you rush to the door beyond and fling it open. Beyond the heavy door, a startling scene confronts you. The chamber you have entered is large, measuring 20 meters across. It has black walls, and a large wall screen pulsing red and orange stands at the far end. Otherwise, the room is largely bare, but you can make out several stone thrones in the distance. They are set out before what looks like a huge sarcophagus. On top of the sarcophagus is a sculpted figure of a demon, and this stone figure holds a metal lever in one hand and a whip constructed of glowing metal links in the other. Glowing gems are set in the eye sockets and fingers of the statue. 2 figures are standing behind the throne. One is a massively muscled man-orc clad in heavy banded armour and wielding a powerful-looking curved scimitar. The other is a slender, wiry, dark-haired man in wizardly robes, not tall and slightly stooped. Neither appears to be bothered at your entry. The wizard looks at you and then at the man-orc. Kill him, will you, Drazg? I've got more important things to do. The wizard says contemptuously and turns away. Your blood boils at this insult to your ability. I mean, is it an insult if it's true? My fighting ability is not great. You charge to fight the man-orc. You soon discover he is no ordinary man-orc. He is very powerful and nimble on his feet despite his considerable size. His eyes burn with a malign intelligence rare among his people. He's not going to be easy to defeat. There is a picture of the man-orc champion standing with his scimitar ready to attack, the wizard pointing and instructing the man-orc to attack, and the big statue in the background. Yeah, solid. Not great, but solid. Which I feel as though has been the kind of general feel of the art. None of it's been superb, but a lot of it's been really solid. Anyway, the man-orc champion has a skill of 10 and a stamina of 10. I have a skill of 8 and a stamina of 3. After 3 attack rounds have passed, you need to make note of the man-orc's skill and current stamina. and then go somewhere else. But I think that's unlikely to happen, since me surviving for three rounds is unlikely. So probably for the final time this adventure, I'm going to roll some dice. He killed me on the third attack round. I dealt no damage to him, but we did draw one combat round. So that, I think, will be the end of the adventure. I have been slain by a man-orc champion. Tragic. I'm not going to invoke the Sausagey Finger bookmark rule, as I've been recording for a bit over an hour. I'm going to go away, however, and play it on my own time. I've had quite a good time with this. I feel as though maybe the latter stages of this playthrough were a little bit heavy on the combat encounters. They do get a bit wearisome when they're just back-to-back like that. But I feel as though I'm really intrigued by what's going on with this sphere. The travel time thing's been really cool. I'll try on my next attempt to just go hell for leather and see how quickly I can get to the sphere, see whether that makes a difference. I feel as though I do need to pick up a mace, though. So, yeah, let's see what happens. Interestingly, the honour score hasn't been a big deal yet. I don't really have a sense for exactly how much more of the book there is either. I mean, I feel as though there's at least one big act left to explore. Anyway, yeah. Fascinating, tantalising, intriguing. Those are all words. I'm going to go away and play Tower of Destruction. And I'll be back for you in just a couple of seconds. Tatty bye. This is a book that I want to love, but for everything in it that is awesome, there's another element that is doing its level best to annoy me. On balance, I feel like this is almost two books, one great and the other quite irritating, to be honest. The first thing that struck me when I finally finished Tower of Destruction is just how long it felt. It's up there with Caverns of the Snow Witch for feeling like a bit of a slog, though it is structured rather more interestingly than Caverns of the Snow Witch was. You've got four different sections, the first where you're trying to find the sphere, the second inside the sphere, the third which is an ice palace, and the fourth which is the Tower of Destruction itself. Of these, the first, second and fourth are basically linear, while the third and by far the most interesting section, the ice palace, allows you to explore areas in whatever order you would like. The three more or less linear sections do have limited scope for having different adventures, but you're being trammelled into a fairly straightforward route. Someone claimed online that the ideal path through Tower of Destruction is around 180 sections long, which feels about right. You are going to see almost half of the total on the optimal route, which means that you'll probably see over half the available sections on a successful run, allowing for a couple of digressions along the way. It's amazing how different in length two 400 section adventures can actually feel. Citadel of Chaos is 400 sections, but basically takes place in an incredibly cramped space that's full of intricate choices. This one feels like a real epic, and that's a function of having a broadly linear design. Even though you can do the Ice Palace in whatever order you like, the best path will still take you to all of the available locations in the palace, meaning that it's actually quite linear once you unpick the correct route, because there's only one right path through it. It's telling that at no point while I was playing Tower of Destruction did I feel even the slightest urge to take a look at a map. Now, how this lands depends largely on taste. For myself, I feel like I would have liked the whole book to be the Ice Palace and thrown in a couple of different paths you could take through the locations so that you could have different adventures. If you die in Tower of Destruction, you will be having broadly the same adventure you did last time with a few variations. And boy, does it start to feel like a bit of an imposition on your third or fourth attempt. I thought I was probably quite a long way through the adventure when I concluded the recording, but actually I was about a third of the way through, if that. And this sense of slogging your way through the book is a shame, because the Ice Palace is great. It's the frozen remains of an elven city now given over to the dead and the dark elves that have taken control of it. Somewhere in the city, the original masters might be able to help you in your quest to destroy the Flying Tower. You're presented with a list of locations and just told to have at it, and this is the kind of design I very much enjoy. You've got a bunch of thematically related but distinct locations, and you unravel elements of the background as you travel through them. There's lots of really imaginative high weirdness to be found along the way, which I always appreciate. You get to meet both the original inhabitants of the palace, mostly as ghosts, and the invaders who've taken over. There's all sorts of useful items to find and a handful of puzzles to solve. And there's some really strong encounter design in the Ice Palace. I particularly like the combination of leftover magical oddities and cynical dark elves and the omnipresent ice providing an overarching aesthetic. Constantly running across the souls of the original elves who lived there gives it a slightly melancholy feel, which very much landed with me. This is the part of the book that feels closest to Martin's previous book, and his best book so far, Vault of the Vampire, and it does a great job of offering freedom, but also a sense of progressing through the story when you do things in the right order. The Ice Palace is also the only part which makes heavy use of the hidden paragraph mechanic to counter cheaters. We all know this mechanic annoys me, but this is probably the best implementation we've seen in Fighting Fantasy. I think all of the hidden paragraphs relate to things you do or find in the relatively tight space of the Ice Palace, and the fact that you can explore all the locations from the very start makes trying to hunt for relevant items and clues feel just much less of a chore than in other books. It feels fairer compared to wondering if you should have taken a random left turn 100 paragraphs ago on a different continent. I'm someone who enjoys intricately constructed areas, and this is the bit of the book that feels closest to that. I will say the encounter design is a little rudimentary in terms of depth. There's a fair few repeated motifs, like shooting dark elves with your crossbow before you fight them, which do get a bit repetitive. But at the same time, it also makes the location feel coherent and unified, which is good. There's also a lot of golems in this book. Man likes a golem. The obligatory puzzles, on the other hand, are less of a success for me. I'm fine with rummaging through the decayed ruins of an elf city, looking for the 6 or 7 bits of tat with numbers scrawled on them that can help me on my quest. I'm much less comfortable with being asked to do logic puzzles along the way. One of the things that I like about this book is that there's occasionally a silly tone. There's a goofy sense of humour that sometimes crops up and adds some welcome levity to the story, as well as reminding me that this is a book aimed at kids rather than jaded 40-somethings with too much time on their hands. However, I think the intended audience is going to struggle massively with the puzzles. I got one of them without help. A puzzle that required spotting that the gaps between a series of numbers were squared prime numbers. I felt really pleased with myself until I remembered that it is a book aimed at 10-year-olds. There's a clock puzzle that I didn't even try to solve because the scan was too low resolution to make out the details. That did seem pretty hard when I looked at the solution. There's also a cipher which looks at a first glance like musical notes on a stave. It is not musical notes on a stave. It's actually a letter substitution cipher pretending to look like notes. Some people online have complained that you need to read music to solve it, but you don't because it isn't music, not least because it doesn't actually have a clef to tell you what the notes are. And what look like markings for the different lengths of note are actually nothing of the sort. So in practice, it looks like notes, but it's actually a version of the Dancing Man cipher from the Sherlock Holmes story, The Adventure of the Dancing Men. It's really hard to solve, and I think the code is also mildly broken. As are both the prime number puzzle and the clock face puzzle. The prime number puzzle is missing one prime, and the clock face puzzle is just wrong. I'm not the biggest fan of the use of formal puzzles in fantasy adventures. It's something I think you need to either make a feature of or not do at all, and if you're going to make a feature of it, you need to come up with a narrative reason why all these brain teasers are lying about the place, like my late father's discarded Sudoku puzzles. It doesn't need to be a good reason. A mad sage who loves riddles and uses them all over their lair is absolutely fine with me. But in most settings, and indeed here, they stick out a bit. Why has someone inscribed the password to a door elsewhere in the city on a sheet of ice in their music room in code? And why have they written down the complete instructions for opening the door rather than just the password? We will never know. If you're going to include this sort of thing, they do at least need to be done right. And that's not the case here, which is kind of unforgivable. Thankfully, this being a game book, if you get completely stuck on a puzzle, you always have the option of just laboriously searching through the book looking for the right answer by a process of elimination. There is no anti-cheat protection a writer can come up with in a game book that a diligent 10-year-old with nothing better to do can't outfox by sheer brute force, and I genuinely love that about game books. Let's have a think about the mechanics. Firstly, the use of the core mechanics is solid for the most part. There's quite a few monsters with combat tricks and various items you can use to improve certain fights. There's a slightly different version of the rules for combat with multiple enemies, which is cleaner, with only the highest attack score in a round dealing damage. But it's not clear from the rules as written when you choose who you are going to damage, whether you do that before rolling the dice or after rolling the dice. I like the original combat rules as written because you get to make more choices and there's a degree of strategy to it, but this is definitely simpler and that does count for something. There's not a huge amount of variation in the additional combat rules with various monsters. Most of them have some version of an extra damaging attack, but the presence of them is nice. Not everyone does that. There's quite a lot of variation in the skill of the monsters, which sounds great in principle, but actually the presence of several high skill monsters means that to win, you'll actually need a high starting skill, which makes that variability of skill in the monsters meaningless, since if you've got a suitably high skill to actually beat the game book, all of the early fights are just cakewalks. And it's the usual balance issues that bedevil the series. It's something you can use to take the character on a journey where they get more skill as they go along. And there are a fair few ways to get more skill in Tower of Destruction, but the final fight is so hard that you still need a very high starting skill to get past it. There's no easy solution to the balance issues, but making it so that a less than stellar character can still get a decent way through the story, that is a worthwhile thing to do, and I appreciate seeing it here, even if it doesn't work in the long term of beating the game book. There's also a fair few luck tests, but none of them, I don't think, is an instant death, and the book is fairly generous with handing out luck points. The use of provisions is quite fun in the early stages. Always good to see food being used as food rather than a delicious first aid kit. Actually, the fact that food can be used as a first aid kit is what makes food as a mechanic interesting, because when you eat food to stave off hunger, it does actually have a mechanical cost of 4 stamina. That's 4 stamina that you can't then claim by eating the food when you've not been instructed to. And being forced to actually eat from time to time does make the world feel more real. It provides another avenue for reminding the player that they're under pressure and backs up the time elapsed mechanic. And that mechanic is sort of good, sort of bad, mostly a near miss. I originally intended to go hell for leather on my second playthrough and see just how quickly it was possible to get to the evil sphere. The problem is, all of those enticing side tracks were just too much. I ended up taking even longer to get there on my second playthrough than I did on my first. Now that's good because it's testament to how appealing the encounters on the journey are. I'm a sucker for those kind of wilderness encounters, I really love them. But they are all adding time to your journey. On that score, I would have appreciated a reminder in the text to add one to the elapsed time. I missed a couple through sheer overexcitement about what might happen next. In general, if you're doing mechanical things, I think you should always specify it, even if it seems obvious in context. When people are absorbed in your narrative, it's quite easy to forget about recording another day on your list of how many days it's taken to get somewhere. Those enticing sidetracks kind of revealed to me that, in general, time mechanics aren't a great fit with game books, because they essentially punish you for exploring the environment, which is something you usually need to do in order to win. And any time your game tries to penalise people for doing things that they need to do to win, you are playing with fire. Adventurers accept, for example, that trap chests are a fact of dungeon life, but if you put in too many traps, suddenly you're really penalising players for doing a core adventurer thing of opening every single chest in sight. And then the player will start to resent the fact that they're still expected to open chests in search of the magic doohickey du jour. The time is actually quite well implemented in Tower of Destruction because the dramatic reveal is that it doesn't matter at all. But it'll take a couple of tries before you realise that the time elapsed issue is just a smokescreen, it's a non-issue. There's sufficient useful stuff found on your approach to the sphere that it more than balances the extra fights you have to do, especially once you realise you're going to need a high skill anyway, so you might as well make sure you've got one when you roll up your character. The time pressure is an illusion, and it does something interesting because it serves a purpose of making the first few playthroughs feel really tense. But then once you're used to it and realise that it's not an issue, you can just relax and explore the whole area as you were always going to do. So yeah, it's quite clever in that sense. The honour system, on the other hand, is just not good. I didn't think it would be good, and I was right. It's not good. For starters, when you externalise the tracking of morality to an abstract score, it creates problems in that the score is tracking the number of moral acts and assigning a value to them. The score cannot tell the book anything about the quality of those acts. This creates a morality exchange of sorts where good acts can be balanced against the bad. A mechanical problem arises when your scale is not sensitive enough. In Tower of Destruction, for example, you lose 2 points of honour for doing a heinous and unprovoked murder, but if you do 2 reasonably good things, they will each grant you 1 point of honour, and that will mechanically cancel out the murder. At that point, the murder ceases to have any meaningful effect. Your honour score is the same as it would have been if you'd simply not done anything either good or bad along the journey. And that's simply not the way that most societies view crime in general and murder in particular. It's not a defence in a court of law to say that you gave money to charity or helped someone to learn to play the piano and therefore this one murder probably shouldn't count. It doesn't make any sense that someone who's done a murder and then done a few good deeds and someone who's just neutral should have the same honour score. That just does not make any sense. It's worth pointing out that this transactional view of morality was something that Jimmy Savile, the DJ charity worker and systematic abuser of the vulnerable, spoke about. He claimed in several interviews to have a deal with God, who he referred to as the man upstairs, where he could indulge his urges because he had given so much time and money to charity. And he certainly did do a lot of charity work. But history hasn't tended to focus on that because of the awful harm he did to so many people who came into his orbit. Transactional morality systems are not good because the quality of moral acts, the specifics of them, matter. And a number cannot capture those specifics. This doesn't mean that you can't have morality systems or that they can't be abstracted. It just means that it's very difficult, and I think the best morality systems are generally unidirectional. The humanity system from the White Wolf game Vampire the Masquerade is a good example. Humanity represents a character's connection to the values and emotions they had when they were a normal living person. As you do terrible things, you lose humanity, and you become more and more animalistic and less empathetic. Lose all of your humanity points and you become a mindless beast. You can gain humanity points, but it is intentionally really hard and usually requires a huge investment of time and effort and often requires your character to step away from the politics and backstabbing that make up the bulk of the average vampire game. Essentially, you don't get any points for doing nice things in Vampire, but you definitely lose points for doing horrible things. And one of the tensions in the game is the challenge of retaining your humanity whilst also prospering in the cutthroat world of vampire society. And this works because it is basically unidirectional. Humanity can be lost, but can very rarely be gained. And this is something that I think you could adapt to a gamebook. If your honour score had started high and then only trended downwards when you did bad things, it would have worked better. because it gets rid of that ability to offset evil. In the real world, doing good things is rarely recognised or rewarded directly, but the presumption is that breaking the law will be punished. Someone who takes a life will be sent to prison, but the most someone who saves a life can reasonably expect is getting their picture in the paper and possibly some sort of medal. Good deeds are, to a great extent, expected to be their own reward, and I think that is a better approach to take when designing morality systems in games. The problem with morality systems which ascribe a number to moral acts is more acute in game books than in tabletop games. If a character in a tabletop game does something genuinely terrible, then as well as the mechanical penalty, the game is flexible enough to allow for those acts to have consequences, because the game's master and the other players will remember the specific thing they did and can react appropriately. When you come to the honour check towards the end of Tower of Destruction, the spooky elf who's passing judgment knows what different honour scores broadly mean, but he doesn't know anything about the actions that you took to get that honour score, leading to him basically saying, yeah, you're fine even though you've done a murder. I think in general you're better off ditching the numerical value and looking at adding keywords or objects to specific encounters with a moral dimension to track them in that way. With a bit of careful design, this will allow you to track the things that you're really interested in, and you can even have a bit of fun with it by tying it to something seemingly innocuous like treasure. I like the idea that perhaps in a game book you only get gold by doing faintly nefarious things, and you only get gems by doing truly terrible acts. The spooky elf can then notice how much gold you've got and shrug and go, yeah, okay, not great, you've done some petty larceny, but I understand that this is a dangerous world and we all do what we need to do to get by. Oh, but is that a ruby you've got? You can only get the ruby by having murdered someone in their sleep. That definitely tips you over into being a terrible human being. It's worth noting, mechanically speaking, that Fighting Fantasy already has a kind of morality system that's fairly widely used across the series. Traditionally, the luck system has been used as a kind of karma, with bad decisions reducing your luck and good decisions increasing your luck. This is a lighter touch than the honour system and seems to work fairly well. It gestures vaguely in the direction of punishing people for doing bad things, without getting into the complicated discussion of how it actually works. Do bad stuff and the universe might turn against you a bit on top of any narrative consequences that the murder could have. I think it's telling that losing honour in Tower of Destruction often involves losing a point of luck, a good indication that the system is in some ways fairly redundant. So does this mean that you shouldn't include morality in your game books? No, partly because you will always include morality in your game books whether you intend to or not. You'll just include it in a way that you haven't examined, and it'll be based on your assumptions about the world rather than thoughtful decisions you've made about the world. But I think you can still include morality in an explicit way in a gamebook format, provided you stick to pretty structured morality systems. Having the character be a paladin who needs to maintain favour with their gods to keep their special paladin powers is the good example of something that operationalises pretty well into a gaming setting and a game book in particular. You could play with the pirate code from Pirates of the Caribbean. That could also be a lot of fun. In these examples, crucially, you're using morality to try and reinforce the core fantasy of the story. You are trying to punish people when they don't behave like a paladin or don't behave like a pirate, and give them some sort of in-game reward when they embrace the fantasy. I generally would avoid trying to turn morality into a number unless you've got a very clear idea of what kind of game effect that number is going to have. I think it's much better to use the narrative to explore the moral consequences of actions, but if you're going to have a morality score, have it start high and then decline when you do terrible things. Although I've gone on at some length about how bad the honor system is, I will say there are some cool design decisions in Tower of Destruction as well. There's a necessary secret door in the sphere which you find with a successful skill test, but failing to find it just sends you back earlier into the sphere so you can actually come back to the secret door room as many times as you need to, provided you're able to defeat the regenerating smoke wraith that guards it. And that is a really clever bit of design. Making you roll to find a secret door makes intuitive sense on one level. A secret door you can automatically find doesn't make much sense, but equally you don't want to gate all further progress off behind a single roll if you can avoid it, and making it so that you can go back and try again fixes that issue nicely. There's also an occasional wrinkle to a random test where it's a D6 50-50 roll, but you can choose to spend a point of luck to add 2 to the roll. This is fascinating, and on some level, a better luck mechanic than the existing one, since it allows you to pick and choose when to spend the resource, adding a layer of strategy to it. I really like that, because it turns luck into something you've got a bit of control over, a bit like your provisions. The only downside is that in a game book you're likely to be playing several times. It does create an incentive to hang on to your luck and only spend it if you've learnt the outcome. Will be really bad if you don't use your point of luck to improve the roll. But that's just one of those things that you get with the format, so I don't think it's necessarily a knock against the mechanic per se. I don't think I'd want it to totally replace the luck mechanic. I think sometimes having a luck roll forced on you is a good thing, but having the option to preserve your luck score if you think you're going to need it for later is good. In terms of the other elements, the book is generally strongly written, doesn't take itself too seriously. I think the art contemplates the action nicely, though it's clear that Peter Nifton is better at some elements than others. He's great at doing demons, golems and people in armour, but his backgrounds and his faces aren't maybe the strongest. Still, the art is solid and the book as a whole feels quite absorbing as a result. It is not the most carefully proofread book in the series. There's a few sections that don't link together very smoothly. There's issues with all three of the big puzzles, and more than a few things that seem like actual errors in the text as well. The page on the Fighting Fantasy Wiki lists them all, and there's more than you would generally expect from a book produced by a major UK publishing house, and it does make me wonder whether the onus of dealing with these kinds of errors fell more on the writer than on the copy editor. Overall, Tower of Destruction is a little bit of a curate's egg. The good bits are really good, but the bad bits are deeply frustrating. There's a tremendous imagination on display in terms of the imagery. I love the fact that the ultimate baddie is a flying tower that's also a B-52 bomber. That's great. The tower and the sphere and the various surreal locations in the Ice Palace are wonderful examples of the kind of high weirdness I associate with Michael Moorcock when he was on a lot of drugs and cranking out material at a ferocious pace in the 1960s. I love all of that. I think it would have benefited from some of the encounters feeling a little bit more complex in order to make the book feel less like a slog, and it's absolutely crying out for some genuinely optional areas and multiple paths through some of the set pieces. I enjoyed it, but I did feel quite tired by the time I finished it. That's all for this episode. I'll be back in April with the second book in the Way of the Tiger series, so there's something to look forward to. If you've enjoyed this podcast, do consider leaving a review or rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps more people find the podcast. You can contact me by following me on Blue Sky at HJ Doom. Thank you very much for listening. Take care. And I'll see you soon.